yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets of screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. This week, we're going to continue our discussion of the topic, what's wrong with economists? We might call this, what's wrong with economists, part two. Okay, let's jump into it. Well, last week, I started off talking about what I call the two main wings of professional economics. One wing I call the retroclassicalist, the other hybrid Keynesians. Now these adjectives, retro and hybrid, are purposeful. Retro means turning back, right? One wing really relies on 19th century classical economic analysis, where money and money supply is the key to whether we get economic growth or too much inflation. Okay, retroclassicalists, they believe money is the key. And then we have hybrids. Why do we call them hybrids? Because they think they're Keynesians, but they're not. They pick and choose a few things from Keynes that they think are relevant, and then they also jump back to the 19th century and pull up some of these old ideas, and they try to forge them together, hybrid of pre-Keynes and Keynesian notions, and you get a bastardized version of Keynes that is also incorrect. Okay, who are these guys? Well, on the monetarist side, you know, we have guys like John Taylor and Hubbard and, you know, all these folks. They get a lot of press coverage. Chicago School, they get, to write long feature articles in Wall Street Journal and so forth. And then we got hybrids, people like Paul Krugman, Joe Stiglitz, etc. Those types. Robert Reich. And they get to write articles in the New York Times. Right? Or appear on MSNBC and so forth. Okay. So, let's talk about them a little bit more. And then I want to move on and talk about maybe something on the left. What I call neo-Marxists. Neo, again, the adjective is important because, like the hybrid Keynesians, they don't really understand Marx. And we'll get to them shortly. But some more commentation on the hybrids. Okay. We ended last week with the major points. One, that hybrids think low interest rates and money, i.e. QE, quantitative easing, right, where the Federal Reserve prints money, throws it into the economy. Well, it doesn't really pump it into the economy, folks. Let's get through the obfuscation here. Where does the Fed money go? Who gets this Fed money? Well, there's two sources. Banks who can come to the Fed and borrow the money from the Fed at super low rates. Okay, and even leave it with the Fed, less than, 0.25%. Or they can borrow from each other at even less than that because of Fed actions and money supply actions reduces the federal funds rate, the bank-to-bank loan rate. That's the Fed drives that anyway. We won't get into the details how it does, but it does. And that's, like 0.1%. And then they can borrow money from the Fed, and they can leave the money in the Fed there until they decide what to do with it and get interest on it. So they don't have to do anything but make an electronic transaction and make money off of it with the Fed. Okay, but, they do use it. But who do the banks give this money to? You know, they get it at super low rates. It costs them virtually nothing, sometimes less than nothing, and then they loan it to who? Okay, they loan it supposedly to businesses that supposedly invest, create jobs, so over. Nope, not the case, mostly. Okay. Who do they loan it to? They loan it to wealthy institutions and wealthy investors through those institutions. And what do those institutions do? Well, then they just pump the money into the stock market in the U.S. and worldwide, and all the other financial speculative markets. It goes offshore sometimes for a while, at least to finance real growth in Brazil and China and places like that, but even that's disappearing now. Okay, so that's where the money goes. And then there's this thing called QE, where the Fed prints money, over $3 trillion worth, $85 billion a month. And where does that money go? Well, that money goes to wealthy holders of mostly busted subprime mortgage bonds and some other treasury bonds. Okay, in other words, the Fed prints money, buys these bad assets, these busted assets from these folks, wealthy, super wealthy, or what we call very high net worth individuals and their institutions, you know, their hedge funds, private equity funds, and so forth. Those are the guys that the Fed is buying the junk from, and we don't know what they're paying. The Fed's paying. They're probably paying above market price for this stuff, so it's a freebie, right? It's like if you had a house that was well underwater in terms of mortgage, the Fed come along and buy it at your purchase price back from you and then let you sit in it. Okay? That hasn't been done, of course, for homeowners, but that's essentially what's been done for wealthy investors. So that's what QE is, and that's what zero rates are. That's the Fed monetary policy. And, you know, hybrids like Paul Krugman and others think that that's good. You know, they were on the side of having Janet Yellen, the new Fed chair-to-be, follow in the footsteps of Ben Bernanke, who's retiring, who have been embracing this policy of QE and low interest rates. They're all for it. You know, the hybrids, the Krugmans, Stiglitzes, and all those guys, Reichs, they think that's good, and they want more of that. And they, you know, cheered for Janet Yellen, who's just carrying on the work of Bernanke, who carries on the work of the big banks. I mean, look, follow the money. Who's winning? Who's benefiting from this? It's the big banks, who then pass it through to their speculators, the shadow banks. By the way, you know how much money is held in the shadow banks? What's the investable asset value within the shadow banks? Who are the shadow banks? Well, investment banks, insurance companies, custodial banks, hedge funds, private equity firms, money market funds, blah, blah, blah. All of these, they're the real banking system, quote, banking. Now, there's a few big guys left, you know, like J.P. Morgan and Wells and so forth, who are playing in this game, who are also traditional banks. Traditional banks take deposits from retail customers, folks like you and me. You know, shadow banks don't take money from you and me, although they're opening that up. Right? You know, they get money from the wealthy, the very high net worth individuals, people making over $30 million a year in income. I'm not saying that's the value of their assets. That's the value of their income flow every year from those assets. Those are the key folks. That's the new capitalist class that's driving it all. That's the new finance capital in the 21st century. Those are the key players and their institutions that they put their money in. And sometimes, you know, they play games buying derivatives and real estate and so forth on their own. They don't even go through institutions. Sometimes they do. Okay. Now, hybrids believe that what the Fed is doing, low interest rates, QE and so forth, is good to stimulate economic growth. That's the argument. Oh, we need low interest rates to stimulate economic growth. Well, we've had low interest rates for 5 years. What's it done? Has it really stimulated economic growth? No, it's really stimulated the stock and bond markets, hasn't it? That's where the money's gone. We don't know how much has gone into derivatives because there's no way of reporting that. Or global real estate, so forth. That's where the money has gone. It hasn't gone to stimulate real investment, creating real jobs, creating real income for the bottom 90% that would generate consumption, that would generate economic growth, sustained economic growth. No. Well, hybrids believe that. They believe that low interest rates, QE, stimulates GDP economic growth. Wrong. Evidence, 5 years, look at it. Not even here in this country, but everywhere. Right. Interest rates drive the economy, is what they believe. And money supply provided by low rates and QE drive interest rates that drive investment, that drive the economy. That's the big misrepresentation, falsification of hybrid economics. There's many, but that's one. They believe low rates drive investment. Not much economic data to show that, prove that anymore. But, you know, they don't talk about that much in the press. All right. So, you know, the hybrids are dead wrong. And if we call them Keynesians, they aren't Keynesians. In fact, if you read Keynes' general theory, he's very clear. Low interest rate won't get you out of a contraction. Yes, Keynes does not believe that. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not making a big deal about Keynes. I'm not a big Keynes fan or so forth. But you got to admit what he said, what is correct, what's correct. He's a heck of a lot more correct than his Epigenes. In other words, his descendants, the hybrids. They're hybrids because they pick and choose from Keynes. And in the case of this interest rate idea, low interest rates drive. That's not Keynes. That's part of pre-Keynes. That's part of the neoclassical or classical economics, which was dead wrong. So that part of the hybrids is not really Keynesian. But we call them Keynesians anyway. Well, not true. They're not really Keynesians. Okay. But, you know, Keynes had a few things that were worth listening to, that he was right on. For example, if you ever bother to read the general theory, most people don't. In fact, people go through an economic education and never read it anymore. Never read the general theory. It's not required for undergraduates. Even most graduates never, in economics, never read it. Most of your professors out there have never read the general theory, let alone Keynes's treatise on money, which preceded that. And the two have to be read together because they are really different focuses. Now, Keynes's treatise on money is really about the money side of the equation and how finance impacts the economy. They never read that, never. Okay, in the general theories about the real side of the economy. But Keynes did say two things, actually three things that are really important. One, he concludes the general theory by saying capitalism has two big problems. One, it cannot create sustained jobs. It always tends to create a situation where jobs decline, where you have excess unemployment. It cannot solve the unemployment problem. Sounds pretty radical, doesn't it? Yeah. Secondly, capitalism has a tendency towards income inequality over the long run, which is a problem for it over the long run. Oh, gee, can't create jobs, income inequality. Does that sound familiar, folks? Yes, that's Keynes, but do you hear these hybrid Keynesians talk about this? Oh, now they talk about income inequality. Get me wrong. Oh, I'm sorry. You know, oh, Robert Bryack and Stiglitz, they're all talking about income inequality. But you ever read their books to the very end? What did they say is the solution to it? They have no solution except job training, you know, and the new technology or something like that. There's no solutions. These guys will go up to the cliff and not step off the cliff. and propose things that really must be proposed if you're going to stop the long-run decline going on. Okay, so that's the hybrids, the hybrid Keynesians. That's only one thing that's wrong. We'll get to some other things here, right? Now we got the retroclassicalists. What do they think about money and interest rates and the Fed and QE and so forth, right? Well, their view is that money supply, increasing the money supply, QE, low interest rates, right, will only generate inflation in goods and services. Inflation. Well, where's the inflation? We got a deflation problem. You know, we're less than 1% consumer price index increases, and it's been slowing since 2009. And you look globally elsewhere, it's even worse. You had deflation in Japan, you know, temporarily being reversed, but that will lag again. In fact, they can't make their goal of 2%. In Europe, you got deflation, it's flat. Got deflation trends and tendency towards deflation occurring all over the globe for the last 4 years, incessantly. Okay, so where's the inflation in goods and services that the retros say will occur? Nowhere. So they're wrong about the impact of money and QE and low interest rates on inflation, just as the hybrids are wrong of the impact of money, interest, low rates on real economic growth. They're both wrong. Why are they both wrong? Interesting question. Well, I argue for the following reason, that they're both wrong. All right. Lower interest rates, the Fed, money supply, QE, etc., does not lead to inflation in goods and services, does not lead to economic growth. Fed policy the last 5 years, $13 to $20 trillion in money injection into the economy in various ways. Other central banks doing more, adding more injection of liquidity money into the system, right? Okay. This low interest rates, money injection, does not lead to real economic growth in the U.S. It leads to the money flowing out of the U.S., and going to finance economic growth elsewhere in the world for a while. Okay, now that game is coming to an end, too. Yeah, you know, the BRICS, Brazil, and China, and Indonesia, places like that, South Africa, that's where the money was flowing for a couple of years, offshore. But even more than that, flows into speculative investing. It goes into financial securities, it goes into the stock market, it goes into the junk bond market, it goes into these other financial securities markets. And you know what? It creates inflation in financial securities. Look at the stock markets, look at the bond markets, record growth. Oh, so it does create inflation, but in financial assets, not in real goods and services. That's where the retros get it wrong. And it doesn't generate growth in real investment and real jobs, it generates growth in the financial sector. That's where hybrids get it wrong. But they're still passing this crap in their economics classes. I can't believe it. I listen to some of this stuff and read the books that they reread and rewrite each other. They both assume, right, that interest rates and bank loans, in other words, determine investment or inflation. They assume bank lending is the essence of credit. In other words, when banks lend money, they extend credit, and whoever gets the money assumes a debt. Now, credit and debt are two sides of the same coin, but this comes from the banks, who are influenced by the Federal Reserve and extending, quote, bank loans and credits. But what this totally ignores is the role of what's called inside credit and the shadow banking system, i.e. the $70 trillion that they're sitting on globally, and they're all over the world. Now, they don't have offices in on the corner of your local town. It's all electronic. Okay. Inside credit, shadow banks. We're getting closer to the real cause of what's going on here. Federal Reserve has no influence over that. Okay. Hybrids don't understand the credit-debt relationship and the relationship of credit, particularly inside credit, to investment, and the distinction between real asset investment and financial asset investment. Investment is investment to them. And because they look at, you know, national income product accounts, GDP, and so forth, it's really only real investment because that indicator excludes financial investment. It's not included in GDP. Ah, but it's very disruptive, destabilizing financial asset investment. They don't understand the relationship between these two forms of investment, real investment and financial investment. They therefore don't understand the relationship between inside credit and outside credit, meaning credit by banks. They don't understand the relationship between shadow banks and traditional banks. They believe low interest rates lead to borrowing, and thus lead to investment, or in the case of retros, more inflation than investment. Okay, well, where does this low interest rates and this QE really go? Well, it gets borrowed by the banks from the Fed, right? In that sense, the money comes from the Fed to the banks, right? And then it goes through the banks. The banks charge a spread on it, and it goes to these other institutions and so forth, and offshore and financial, and et cetera. But what do these institutions do? Well, we have a problem here with cash hoarding going on. Big corporations, both financial and non-financial, are sitting on a ton of cash, liquid assets, ton, and not investing it in the U.S., and when they do invest into financial securities or offshore. And how big is that? $10 trillion. There's a $10 trillion cash hoard on the sidelines, just in the U.S. I'm not counting elsewhere. And what are corporations doing? Well, they're buying back stocks, buying back their stock. They're paying out dividends, trillions of dollars in the last couple of years in dividend payouts and stock buybacks. I just wrote a three-part article called The Great Corporate Tax Shift. You can read it on my blog, jackrasmus.com, or on my website, kyklosproductions.com, kyklosproductions.com. Or you can read the series in Counterpunch, or on ZNet, or on Talking Union. It's appearing in all those places, and the full article appearing this month in Z Magazine, by the same title, with tables and graphs and all that kind of stuff, okay? So it's cash is being hoarded, record amounts. It's being spent on stock buybacks and dividends. It's going into offshore markets, emerging markets, as real investment, and most of it's probably going into financial speculation, okay? So that's what's happening with low interest rates. Yes, it's causing inflation, but in financial assets, and it's not resulting in real investment and expansion. It's resulting in expansion offshore and expansion of the financial sector. That's what's happening. Now, hybrids assume, wrongly, that bank lending and interest rates drive investment. That's not true. They think that's the main connection, the main thread, right? Lower interest rates, banks make loans, business take the loans, business invest, drive investment, real assets and jobs and so forth. No, that's not how it works. What else determines investment? Whether we're talking about financial asset investment or real asset investment, what else determines it? Well, the amount of retained earnings that corporations have. And as we've pointed out, there's huge trillions of dollars. How do they get all this money, retained earnings? Well, part of it is that they invest in financial securities. You know, most large multinational corporations now, one-fourth or more of their profits come from financial investments. Portfolio investments, they call them. But most of the non-financial corporations have generated huge profits by squeezing costs, particularly labor costs. Wages, benefits, so forth. I mean, we haven't had a real, you know, vibrant consumption recovery here. It's been stop, go for 4 years. So it's not that they're selling more stuff. It's that they're reducing their cost. This is a wage compression-driven profit surge that's been, and it's record profits, folks. I mean, corporate profits, way above what they were during the last boom year, 2006-07. Way above. So they've got a lot of retained earnings. Now, what else? How else do corporations get their money for, quote, investment? Do they get it from banks with low interest rates? No. They issue their own corporate bonds, investment-grade junk bonds, commercial paper, so forth. Huge boom in bond issuances. And, of course, that's all money they get. They give paper to investors, and they get money from them, huge amounts. And or if their stock rises, they issue more stock, equity finance, Apple, good example. And then if their financial assets increase, they can borrow on margin debt, regardless of what the interest rate is, collateral debt, inside debt. Okay, there's lots of ways in which corporations raise funds in order to invest. But the point is they're not investing in the U.S. and job-creating real asset investment. They're investing offshore or investing in financial securities. Okay. Now, both you know, our hybrids and retros are also wrong in that they assume that money supply, you know, the Fed money supply is the key. Neither of them really understand, pay much attention to money demand or money velocity. That's another problem that both of them share. Recall last week, right, when we talked about QE and low interest rates and Fed money supply leading to inflation in goods and services, right? No. Retros are wrong, leads to financial asset inflation. So neither, to summarize briefly, neither the hybrids or the retros are correct. The Fed, QE, money supply does not boost the economy, hybrids, right? The Fed, QE, money supply does not boost goods inflation, retros, right? What it does boost is speculative investment and financial asset prices. And that means the top wealthy 1% get even wealthier and income inequality accelerates. You know, we have this problem, income inequality in the U.S. Yes, it's getting worse. The top 1% is getting more and more of the income growth. In fact, the latest information shows that 95% of all the additional income generated in the last 3 years has gone to the 1%. 95%. You know, during Bush, it was like 65%. That's bad enough. And before that, during Clinton, it was like 45%. But now it's 95%. Amazing. Of the new income generated going to the wealthiest 1%, and within that, the wealthiest 1/10 and 1/100th is even skewed within the 1%. And the rest, particularly the bottom 80-90%, wage stagnation, wage and salary stagnation, because the main determinant of income for the rest is jobs and high-paying jobs. You know, if the jobs that are being created pay less than the jobs that are being lost, you got a decline in wages. If you have chronic 20, 25 million people unemployed, underemployed for 5 years, that's wage compression. So for the bottom, income is declining, which also exacerbates the relative share, the percentage of the 1%. You see, you can the 1% can get more and more money because they're taking a bigger, bigger piece of the pie. But it can also mean that 1% are getting more and more because the rest of the folks are getting less and less of the pie. Or you can have both, which is what we got going on, both things going on. So you got income inequality. So the Fed, QE, money supply, monetary policy is generating income inequality, ultimately. And if you don't create jobs and you have income inequality, you're going to have more or less stagnant consumption, on again, off again, stagnation and consumption. And that's what we got going on now. All of a sudden, we're realizing here, to get to contemporary, oh, retail sales aren't doing so good, except for autos. They're pretty much giving the cars away. Yes, retail sales, big disappointment here. Dropping for the first time in 3 years. Wonder what this fourth quarter is going to look like. You know, third quarter GDP, oh, well, you know, almost 3%. Well, as I said before, that's all because of inventory, largely inventory stocking by businesses, thinking that this was going to be a good retail consumption year, but it's not. So now they're holding all this excess inventory, which means they got to dump it by lowering prices. People are only buying this stuff with big discounts. Why? Because they don't have the income growth. They're buying on credit. And the wealthy is 10% doing well. They're buying too. You know, I mean, Tiffany's and Bloomdale, whatever the hell it's called, they're doing great. But, you know, the Targets and the Walmarts, they're struggling. Well, you know, it's because average folks buy at the latter, not at the former. So neither understand the role of debt and credit, neither hybrids or retros, and neither understand the relationship between real investment and financial investment. Neither understand the role of the speculative investment shift that's going on and the role of shadow banks playing a bigger, bigger role in this, and financial security creations and the global money parade, and how this shift is resulting in a slowing of long-term real growth. The hybrids are monetary policy fools, and the retros are monetary supply fetishists. And both are victims of 19th century economic theory that still permeates their whole conceptual apparatus and undermines their models. Much else could be said that's wrong with them. Their views on government spending effects, on tax cut effects, and deficits, and what's wrong with their tools, the multipliers tool with the hybrids, the elasticity tool with the retros, and of course their assessment of Keynes. Okay, we're going to take a break right now. Then we come back, I'm going to talk about another tendency within economics, the neo-Marxists, and why they're just as wrong as the hybrids and the retros. This is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. Take a break, come right back, and we'll take on the neo-Marxists. Okay, this is Jack Rasmus, your host, and now we're going to talk about the neo-Marxists. I say neo-Marxist because it's not necessarily a critique of Marx that I'm going to be talking about. He had a lot to say that was quite accurate. But, you know, face it, it's 150 years ago, folks. I mean, you know, you can't treat it as if it were a economic Bible. I mean, he couldn't see everything 150 years ago. and certainly couldn't see the trends in finance capital that have occurred. Now, he began talking about, or thinking about finance capital in his volume 2 and 3, especially 3, but you know, he never really published that stuff, so you can't say those are his final views on it. You know? So folks, take Marx's first volume of Capital and some ideas in the second, and they come up with this idea called the falling rate of profit, the tendency of the rate of profit to fall over the long run in a capitalist system. And that supposedly that falling rate of profit is what precipitates crises. Well, what is a crisis? What does he mean by the crisis? Does he mean recessions and depressions? No. There's no linkage between recessions, depressions, and the falling rate of profit, even in his notes. There's discussion about the long-run crisis, this tendency, which could be offset by actions the capitalists take, which they do, which may more than offset the tendency of the rate of profit to fall, right? Look, I can't get into all the details, but basically here's the argument, right? All value is due to labor, okay? And over time, as embedded labor in machinery, equipment, and so forth, he calls that constant capital, rises in relationship to the amount of labor in production, which he calls variable capital, right? And together, the ratio between them is called the organic composition of the capital. Right? Over time, you have constant capital rising in relationship to variable labor capital, and that produces the rate, the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. So falling organic composition over time. It's a long-run view. It's a, in a way, it's a classical economics view of long-run determinants of long-run economic growth. He's not looking at short-run cycles here, business cycles, including depressions. Ah, but that's what the neo-Marxists say. Oh, they say falling rate of profit causes the crises. And as we're going to see, you know, they engage in all these twists and turns to come up with fitting the square hole, the square peg of rate of profit in a round hole of depression or recession. Okay, so back to Marx. Organic composition of capital declines. Fall rate of profit tends to fall. Leads to economic crisis. Neo-Marxists say the crisis is recessions and depressions. So falling rate of profit tendency determines recessions and depressions. Now, the important difference here also is that neo-Marxists are only looking at real production, real investment, real production. They're not looking at the finance side. There is an undeveloped assessment of the role of finance in Marxism, as there is in neo-Marxism. You know, the neo-Marxists say, oh, it's the falling rate of profit and the slowing down of ability to make profit in real production, you know, that leads the capitalists to say, oh, we got to turn to financial speculation in order to make up on the profit. So it's, in other words, the falling rate of profit. Real production drives the rise of profits in finance. There's a direct causative relationship there from the real side and profit on the real side to the financial side. The former determines the latter. Financialization is a function of falling rate of profit in the real economy. Okay. But remember, nothing in Marx says that falling rate of profit has anything to do with business cycles. And besides, Marx is not really focused primarily on the falling rate of profit, although neo-Marxists are. His central concept is capital accumulation. Or investment. We call it real investment today, capital accumulation. And the circulation of money and capital in different forms through the system to come back to stimulate more capital accumulation. So it's investment, capital accumulation, that he's really focused on, but not the neo-Marxists. They're really focused first and foremost on falling rate of profit as a determinant, as the sole determinant of investment and accumulation. Okay. In other words, they're focused only on the real side of production as the source of profits, and profits as the source of investment capital accumulation, right? Profits are the only determinant of in real investment. Both propositions are wrong. Okay. Investment, whether real investment or financial speculation, is a function of more than just profits, and therefore the falling rate of profit, which is just a subset of profits, right? What determines investment, whether real or financial? It's the rate of return. Okay? It's the profitability as measured by a rate of return. Right? That's what determines profits. Oh, profits determines profits? You betcha. Because profits are a source of internal funds for investment. But wait a minute. The new Marxists are wrong because they assume only profits are a determination of profits and investment. What else determines investment? Well, if I'm a company, I can invest in either real assets or financial. I prefer to go to financial because it's much faster and bigger rate of return nowadays. Okay, but put that aside. What determines how and what I invest in? It's not just my retained earnings. It's not just my profits. It's how much money I can raise through issuing bonds. Oh, that has nothing to do with my profits, does it? In fact, a lot of companies raise a lot of junk bond money when they're losing money, when they have no profits. And, of course, if my stocks are going up, my stock price is going up, I can issue more stock, more equity, and I can raise money that way for investing. Or I can just squeeze my workers, drop their health care and squeeze their wages and so forth and generate profit margins, profits as a percent of operating costs, profit margins. And that's most of what the profits have been in the last 5 years, not from sales or price increases. Consumption hasn't been that great. Price increases have been slowing. So it's got to, all the super profits they're making have to come from squeezing their wages, right? Or I can just go out in these global liquid markets and borrow money there if I want, right? In fact, I don't even have to pay anything for it, on margin loans. My collateral, if my prices are going up, I can say I got more collateral and shadow banks can give me money. So there's lots of ways to raise funds in order to invest in real assets or financial assets. You don't need profits. Profits alone do not drive investment. And remember, it's investment in Marx that we're, and capital accumulation that we're primarily concerned with. Profits and falling rate of profits are just one of many determinants of investment. And that's where neo-Marxists get it wrong. They make a fetish out of the profits and falling rate of profits. That's not what drives capitalism. It's the need to invest and expand that drives capitalism, not necessarily the need even to make profits. Besides, what exactly are profits? This is another place that it's another question where the neo-Marxists, kind of chase their tails. There's many definitions of what we mean by profits between countries and even within country and national accounts. Now, they typically use the Bureau of Economic Analysis, which is a very narrow definition of profits. And it's only real profits, by the way. BEA does not include profits from financial investments and assets. But then they tend to strip out other sources of finance and investment and profitability to get a very narrow view and definition of profits that fits their hypothesis, right, that the falling rate of profit drives investment and the crisis. But capitalism is global. If you're going to talk about profits, you have to have a global data collection exercise to see what the profits really are. I mean, how much profit did Apple really make? Well, if you just look at Apple USA, you don't know. Right, you got to look at Apple globally. What's Apple's profit globally? Now, here you get into other problems because there's price differences nation to nation, economy to economy. And there's different definitions of what profits are, and some places profit collection is pretty poor. Go to China, you don't know what the profits are in China. And besides, what about Chinese government-owned, Red Army-owned factories and production? They have no profits, purposely, because of the accounting arrangement. So do you include that or not include that? And then there are many funds, like depreciation funds and so forth, which are really should be considered part of profits, but the neo-Marxists exclude those. Are we talking about before tax or after tax profits? What about business income? You know, it's not called profits in the Bureau of Economic Analysis accounts. Business income is non-incorporated businesses. Well, aren't those profits? Aren't they capitalist too? Shouldn't that not be included? Well, if you do, it shows profits really rising even more than they have been. If you include business income, how about rents? How about royalties? That's not included either. By the way, 65% of small businesses, quote, profits are really considered wages and taken out of the business income box and put into the wages box, which means we overinflate what's happening to wages and underestimate what's happening to business profits in U.S. government accounts. And what about multinationals and their fraud, their internal corporate pricing efforts where they make it look like there's fewer profits in the U.S. so they can move the money offshore? Oh, have you adjusted for that? No. What about all these offshore tax havens where they don't even report corporate profits, right? You stuff your money over there if you're a business, you know, in the Cayman Islands or someplace, and, you know, underestimate your profits in the U.S. so you pay less taxes, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, what is profits? How are you going to measure the falling rate of profit? You can't. But yet they'll argue abstractly that, oh, profits are eight, and then, you know, they'll gerrymander some of the BEA, Bureau of Economic Analysis data, to make it look like you have a tendency of the profit rate to fall. That's why we got a crisis. Well, even that they can't do anymore because profits have just gone through the roof while the global economy has progressively slowed in the last 4 years after a short burst of partial recovery in the first year following the crisis. It's been a long run trend downward. Oh, in between, you know, this quarter, that quarter, you get a boost up and down, but the long run trend is clear. I've written about that recently too. So, you know, the facts are impossible to determine if you're going to use the rate of profit, the falling rate of profit, as the determinant of the crisis. You can't. Because you can't get accurate data for it, for one thing. Second thing, what data you do get, unless you play games with it, shows profits are rising while the global economy is slowing. You see, the problem is a lot of these economists, whether they're neos or retros or hybrids, like to argue that correlations between variables are the same as causation, and they're not. Something can be happening that drive both variables, be it profits and slowing economy or interest rates or money supply and slowing economy, etc. You know, something more is behind the picture here that is responsible for what's going on. That's really the causative variable factor. But they'll argue, oh, profits drive, falling rate drives, interest, lower interest rate will drive, et cetera, et cetera. And then you could logically argue, well, you know, even if you could show a falling rate of profit and a correlation with a crisis, the question is, what's the direction of the correlation? Is it the falling rate of profit, assuming it occurs, is driving the recession depression? Or is the recession depression driving the falling rate of profit? I mean, they're just a correlation. They're moving in the same direction. But what's determining what? What's your transmission mechanism here between the two? Explain and show me some data facts to support your explanation. Okay. Well, the neos can't do that and don't do that. All right. I wrote a very long article for the World Review of political economy called The Bifurcation of Marxist Economic Analysis. That's World Review of Political Economy out of China publication, where I theoretically pretty much addressed a lot of these questions with the falling rate of profit. And people should understand, once again, worth repeating, it's not the falling rate of profit that Marx was concerned about. It is investment, capital accumulation. And profits aren't alone the determinant of investment, and increasingly less so. And especially if you look at the financial sector, where more and more of the profits are. And it's not the real sector profit declining leading to financialization and financial profits. That, again, is a correlation. You could just as well argue that it's not falling investment and profitability in the real economy that's driving financialization and financial sector's expansion and profitability. It's the profitability opportunities in the financial side that is slowing the investment and profitability on the real side of the economy. What's the direction of the correlation again? You could argue, as I argue, that it's the opportunities now that we have a global money parade, we're a global financial system, money moves around, huge amounts of money, explosion of liquidity over several decades now, tens of trillions of dollars out there in the hands of these very high net worth individuals and their institutions, private equity, hedge funds, et cetera, moving the money around. This money is sloshing back and forth. They're investing in very high liquid financial markets because they can jump in and jump out, make money on a short-term price surge, jump out of that, move it somewhere else. They can make the same amount of money in a matter of days or weeks that it would take them years if they loaned to mom-and-pop business to pay them back. Of course, it's mom-and-pop business that creates the jobs and the income for the rest of us, right? But if mom-and-pop, you know, aren't getting the funds for investment, then mom-and-pop, you know, aren't going to invest. You aren't going to get the job creation. You're not going to get the consumption, the income growth for the middle class and the consumption. In other words, financialization, financial profits, financial sector explosion, changing structure of capitalism in the 21st century is sucking money out of real investment in real things that produce jobs, that produce income for the vast majority, that produces consumption, that drives 70% of the economy. In other words, I'm arguing from the other direction, causation, just as arguable as arguing from the real to the financial side. Which one is it? Well, at least it's a debate, right? But if you're a neo-Marxist, you say, no, it's not a debate, because Marx says the falling rate of profit on production and value-based production, productive value, productive labor, is occurring because you have the organic composition of the capital declining, and that's driving the falling rate of profit tendency. And because profits are falling and where labor is concerned, businesses are going and investing in finance. Well, I think they're going investing in finance because it's just a greater return from the beginning. I can make more money in a shorter period of time by investing in that direction than I can investing in real things. Now, folks out in the third world, they still need the real things. So there's real investment going on there because the opportunities are so great over there, you know, in China and Vietnam and Brazil and so forth. But now that's slowing down, too. In other words, we have a conceptual apparatus here in neo-Marxism that is as deficient for understanding 21st century finance capital as the hybrids and the retros conceptual apparatus and models are deficient in understanding what's going on. And that's the situation that we faced. By the way, if you want to read my 20 propositions explaining my view, 20 propositions on the relationship of finance to non-finance capital as the cause of the crisis and what I call a new conceptual apparatus, which looks at systemic fragility, both on the business side, on the household consumption side, and the business side. An expansion of views of Minsky. I'm not a Minskyan, don't get me wrong, but I think he had some insights too, just as Keynes had some insights. And neo-Marxists ought to do what Marx did, and that is read just about everything of by every economist of note before he even wrote his stuff. Thorough critique of political economy. Neo-Marxists, instead of just treating Volume 1 as the Bible, ought to get in and understand bourgeois economics and the positive contributions as well as the junk, and there's hell of a lot more junk than positive, if they want to come up with a true Marxist explanation of what's going on with the current economic crisis. Okay, next week we're going to return back to our theme of is organized labor in the U.S. at a strategic dead end? And we'll have guests from labor, and we'll be talking about that very important subject. Okay, Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions, next week.